Hello and welcome to Motorsport Mentality, the podcast that pauses for thought with the people driving the world's fastest sport. My name is Damian Meaden. So it's our final episode before the Christmas break, and to mark the occasion, we've got an extra special guest for you on today's episode. We'll be delving inside the mind of one of the UK's brightest single-seater talents. He's a race winner in British F4 and GB3, and very recently became the latest recipient of the prestigious Aston Martin Autosport BRDC Award. So grab a coffee and settle in, because this is a personal favourite of mine so far. This is Joseph Loke on Motorsport Mentality. Joseph, welcome to the podcast. I've just given everybody an introduction to you as a racing driver. How would you describe Joseph Loke, the person?
I don't know. I'd say a racing driver would probably be a good start. This is quite tricky. I'd say what I'd like to think I am is quite a big-hearted kind of person that is always trying to make people smile and trying to, you know, just bring good to the world and try and make everyone, the world a happier place, I guess.
I'm curious about your first steps into motorsports. Can you sort of pin down when and where that obsession first started?
So me and my dad used to go rental karting when I was about 10 years old or something. And we'd just, you know, we'd just have a bit of fun, just basically firing each other off and stuff like that. I'm surprised my dad didn't break his back with some of the stuff that we used to do. But yeah, and then my high school had a karting club associated with it, which is quite cool because obviously, you know, very unheard of. So we joined that, started racing. It was only very, very low level, literally grassroots karting, 100 quid a week, and if that. And it was, yeah, just so much fun. And then we were told that, you know, maybe he's actually all right at this and you should try and pursue it a bit. So we were like, right, okay. So we went to the Autosport show, went to see the BRCC Fiesta Junior stand. And I said to my dad, I was like, that'd be so cool if I could race a car. And then, but obviously I thought I'd have to be an adult to race it at the time because I was, I think, 13. And my dad went over and said, how old do you have to be to race in this? And they were like, oh, you have to be 14. And we were like, oh, let's do that then. So yeah, then we raced in Fiestas obviously for 2 years, then got the call from Steve Hunter for F4.
I mean, 10 years old for karting is quite late, relatively speaking, to start. Did you ever feel like there was a degree of you playing catch up to some of the other kids, or did it come quite naturally to you?
Yes, I think I've always had that kind of not really a handicap as such, but like it's always been a bit of a struggle to that I've always been the one with the least mileage going into a season. But with the amount of money that we have as a family, I'm used to that. And that's something that I'm always going to have to put up with in my career. You know, for GB3, I think I'd driven the car 9 times before round one. And, you know, I just have to make do with what we've got. And that's, I think that's what's making myself so proud of what I'm doing. Because I know that there's drivers that will put so many days into testing and stuff like that. And the fact that I can compete and more often than not beat them is, you know, it makes me quite proud.
I mean, Fiestas isn't, I would say, the most established route to then go into single-seaters. Was it always the eventuality, always the aim that you'd go into single-seaters from Fiestas? Or for you and your dad, was it just having fun and then it sort of snowballed and got out of control and got more expensive and got more exciting and just went from there?
Yeah, bang on. No, it was just literally some fun. And my dad has always been really supportive of me. And, you know, if I've said, you know, I'd really love to try this, he'll say, go for it. Do whatever you want to do. Do whatever makes you happy. And that was what we did. And then it kind of, Fiestas was expensive at the time for what we thought. But we were only just getting started. And then, of course, we figured out how much F4 was. But we were like, well, what's the worst that can happen? We'll give it a shot. And then it was a decent season. And from then on, it's been like every year. Maybe after, at the end of 22, I had to convince my dad a bit more. But pretty much every year, he's always been, what's the next step? Where can we go next? Let's see what we can make of this. And, you know, it's pretty cool to have that sort of backing. And of course, the same for my mum as well. My mum, not necessarily from the money side of things, but, you know, she's always next to me at a racetrack and she's always, you know, got an arm around me whenever things don't go well, and always so proud of me when it does. And yeah, the family aspect of things is just way better than anything else that'll ever come out of motorsport.
How much of what you've achieved comes down to your family? Because you've mentioned that that supportive environment that your parents create around you. And it wouldn't be fair to name names, obviously, but there are definitely examples I can think of where I'm like, those parents are definitely living vicariously a bit through the kid, or maybe pushing a bit too much. So how instrumental has it been to your success for you to be in that environment where you're comfortable and you know that it doesn't matter if you finish first or 20th, they've got your back and they're there to help you try and enjoy it and make the most from it?
It's the best thing you can have in motorsport. You know, I'd much rather be in my position where we don't necessarily have the money, but the amount of people that are behind me, you know, not just my parents, but, you know, even you can see the videos from the Young Driver of the Year award at the Autosport Awards. Like, I had a whole table all for me, and, you know, I didn't ask them to be there. They wanted to be there. And it's that you don't get, and it's very rare in motorsport, I feel. Like, there's a lot of drivers that, sure, they have one or two people that are really behind them, but the amount of people, like, my whole family is just invested in me and my racing. And, you know, I have what so many people dream of, and that's something that I'll never ever forget, because it means way more than motorsport could ever mean to a single person ever.
So let's recap the last couple of years of your career for people who are perhaps unfamiliar but learning very quickly about Joseph Lokes. So the move from Fiestas into Formula 4, in my personal opinion, it might be one of the most underestimated steps, people from the outside looking in. Just talk a little bit about how big that adjustment is. You go from a tin top to something with aero and slicks and wings and all the rest of it.
Yeah, it's a massive change. Obviously, the biggest difference is front-wheel drive to rear-wheel drive, because with a front-wheel drive car, you have to slide it everywhere. And a single-seater, while you do have a bit of movement on the rear occasionally, the way that you manage that, the way that you handle it, is completely different. And that was something that took me quite a while to get used to. In the wet, it was okay. I could get used to it because you didn't really need the wings as much and stuff like that. But in the dry, in my first year of F4, I really struggled to just understand the concept of brake earlier to roll more speed through. And I just didn't get that, because Fiestas was barrel as much speed in as you can, and that's quicker. But no, it teaches you to be quite adaptable, I think. It's very difficult making the switch, but once you've done that switch from Fiestas to F4, you can pretty much be able to change your driving style to whatever you need to, because you've gone from one end of the stick to the other. And, you know, you could probably put a driver, for example, Deegan Fairclough, you could probably put him in any car and he'd probably be quite quick. And that comes from the Fiesta to F4 route. You know, it's not the natural progression, but it definitely teaches you a lot.
Can you remember your mindset going into that first F4 season? Because, you know, as we've sort of discussed, it's fun for you and your family that seems to have gotten a little bit out of hand. And then suddenly you're on a grid in a new car surrounded by karting world champions and people who've done this series before and won races, other people who've come up through the same scene as you. You know, you're with, if you like, the best of the best for your age group all of a sudden. And I remember you playing yourself down a little bit, almost as if to sort of measure your expectations. Can you sort of take me back to what your mindset was like going into that first weekend in F4?
Yeah, I was still a very naive kid at the time. And, you know, I'd put a lot of effort in to get to that point. You know, I lost 20 kilos over the winter, and it was so, you know, I'd put so much effort in, but I still didn't feel like I belonged there. It was really weird. Like, I turned up and I'd come from Fiestas, and where you were lucky if you even had a gazebo over your car. And then obviously you've got all the lorries and the big trucks and the massive motorhomes and everything. And it was just so overwhelming. And I remember my first quali, I can't remember it. I think it was my mum came over to me and said, look, it doesn't matter how this goes. Just know that we're proud of you, and we're, you know, whatever you do, we'll be impressed and stuff like that. And I remember doing qualifying knowing that it didn't actually matter how it went, and that made me perform better because I had no pressure. And obviously, you know, I was P4 and P2 in my first quali, and of course a lot of that was down to the team. I think we were, JHR were a bit of a rocket ship at that weekend, but still, you know, to handle a bottle in your first weekend like that, was, I felt it was quite a good job. And I was quite proud of it.
Is that maybe an advantage you had over some of the other drivers, especially the ones with big budget, because they're in the best seats, they've got all the equipment, you want a new set of tyres, no problem, they've done 50 test days. I guess you're almost in a position where the odds are stacked against you. Like, it's more remarkable if you do well than if you don't. So is that quite good at alleviating the pressure for you?
No, because I always want to win, and that's just because I can't make excuses for doing badly, because if I make excuses, I'll never be able to compete with them. So yes, I might have done 20 less days in the car, but if they can do it, then so can I. And that's the mindset that I've always had. I had it in GB3 as well, and I will have it in future years as well. And I don't understand how someone can look at a result and when they're not P1 and go, I'm happy with that, because you can't be, because there's someone that's beating you.
So that first weekend, it's Thruxton, which is, I mean, not even arguably, is in my opinion, the most difficult track that F4 goes to. It's high speed, it's torrential rain. You've qualified well, you're right in the thick of it, and you managed to bring home a race win at the end of your debut weekend. Did that result surprise you?
Massively. Massively, yeah. You know, I think I'd have been happy with the top 10. And then obviously I qualified for obviously race 3 in second, and I knew that Matt Rees's starts, who was on pole, weren't great. He couldn't get his head around the starts. So I was like, well, if I can get myself into the lead off the line, then I've probably got a decent shot. But of course, Thruxton is just a slipstream fest. So, and obviously it's your first weekend, you know, there's so much going on at such high speeds compared to what I was used to. And it meant that there was a lot for me to try and manage and learn. Luckily it was wet, because in the wet I felt a bit more comfortable, and I felt like the battling's a little bit, it's harder to attack people, if that makes sense, around Thruxton in the wet than it is the dry. And so I had a bit more faith in that one. But of course, yeah, it was still a very tricky race. There was a lot of moments when I was very nearly off the track or something like that. But you know, I still remember crossing the line now. It was so amazing to me. Like, the fact that I'd been watching F4 for however many years I've been watching, and I won in my debut weekend. It was a dream. Like, I couldn't process it at the time. And, you know, I still look back at it and I'm like, that's decently impressive, even if I do say so myself.
No, it was brilliant. And obviously at the time I was doing the media for F4, so very familiar with it. And the one thing that sticks out to me is that I never remember an instance after that first weekend where you or your family or anybody around you got carried away. How difficult was it after that win and your first weekend not to readjust your expectations? Because all of a sudden, you've not only surpassed the bar you'd set, you blew it out the bloody water.
Yeah, exactly. I left the weekend in third in the championship. So, and I felt like if things went... Obviously, I'd just come from winning Fiestas, so I did think I was the absolute bee's knees, but obviously, and then to win in debut, I did have a lot of confidence at the time, and I think I came away from that weekend thinking I could fight for the championship, and then obviously the rounds after did not go to plan, and I was just falling down the order in the championship. So, but that was also another lesson that I learned. You know, just because you've had one good round doesn't mean it's going to be an easy season or anything like that, or you're going to be winning at every round or something like that. And GB3 proved it this year, you know. I think my family did a good job of keeping me grounded and you know, making me realise that it wasn't going to be easy, which I thought it was. And it was definitely tricky to kind of, after the rounds that I had afterwards, to then pick myself up again, and then to obviously win a couple of more races in the year was pretty cool.
You won three times in your debut season. I'm going to say Thruxton, Alton and Silverstone from memory. You know, very good, very solid first season, better than a lot of drivers do in their first years. Interestingly for me, though, you decided to come back for a second year in 22 when it switched to the Gen 2 car. Now, to me, albeit not on the same scale, you've sort of just signed yourself back up again for learning a new car. What was the thinking behind that, as opposed to doing what some drivers do and just doing a year in F4 and then going up to GB3 straight away?
So obviously at the time I was still pretty young, so I knew I could get away with it. And it was, my dad really tried to push me into doing GB3 that year, and he still thinks that I should have done that, but I'm happy I did what I did. I think staying in F4, it meant that I was a team leader in JHR. You know, there was times when Georgie would be close to me, but for the majority of the season, I did outperform him, and I felt like that gave me not only a lot of confidence that I started to lack towards the end of 2021, but it gave me the feeling of the team being fully focused around me. And, you know, that was something that I hadn't felt in 2021. Obviously, it was very Matt Rees, Mackenzie Cresswell that year. And plus, it was just another year of learning. So it meant that I could, obviously, it was a completely different car. The first half of the year was shockingly bad. But the second half of the year was really good, and we really improved. And as a team, we got so close that it meant that the transition into GB3 for 2023 was just, you know, it was seamless almost. And it just felt like I was almost in the same championship when I moved to GB3, just a different car. So, it was a tricky decision to make, but I think in the end it's worked out quite well, because obviously I don't think my rookie year of GB3 would have gone as well as it did if I'd have done it in 22 and instead of 23.
No, absolutely. I just want to rewind ever so slightly. You mentioned earlier about the 20 kilos that you lost in weight before you came into single seaters. Now, that is not a small undertaking. And I know that things like weight loss are something that a lot of people really struggle with. Could you maybe just give me an insight into how you were motivating yourself and keeping yourself on the track to make such a big change?
It was a very simple one for me, because I'd done a test day with JHR in November of 2020. And I rolled into the garage, rolled into the car as a bowling ball. And, you know, I got into the car and I was fairly quick, to be fair. You know, I think I was 6/10 off what Pulling was doing. And Steve, after the day, Steve pulled me to the side and said, look, you're quick enough to be an F4 and I'm happy to give you a seat and I want you in the car, but you have to be 64 kilos. And at the time, I think I was 82 or something like that, 82 kilos. So I had to do it. I still remember that exact conversation now. And I, you know, even now I'm training for the next steps, I still remember the words that Steve said of, you have to be ready before you even think about it. And that was, you know, ever since then, I won't even question training or anything like that, just because I know that it's so important. And Steve almost said it as a joke, I found out afterwards. He said, like, you can't really lose it, but, you know, give it a go. And I turned up in mid-February and I was 67 or something like that. And he was like, oh, he said he didn't even recognize me when I walked in. But yeah, no, it was tricky to kind of be strict on myself. Luckily, I think, my dad's got very, very good willpower and stuff like that. And I think I've luckily got that off him. And, you know, I didn't feel it was too tricky to kind of stay on track and stuff like that. But of course, when you've got your mates all saying, oh, do you want to come to Domino's and grab a pizza? Well, no, I can't, sorry. No, I was eating purely meat for 3 months. Yeah, it was tricky, but, you know, I'm very, very glad I did it, because obviously I wouldn't be here.
It sounds like a real first world problem, saying that you've given up Domino's, but do you think that's something else that gets underestimated as well, is the sort of sacrifices you guys make, not just in terms of your diet, but also socially as well? You know, it's not a normal routine. And I mean, even going to motorsport as a journalist, I can't tell you how many birthdays or parties or whatever. Even when I was 17, 18, my mates would be like, you're coming out this weekend. I'd be like, no, I'm not. I've got to go to Croft and cover British touring cars. So yeah, maybe just from a driver's perspective, just try and give people an insight into how much you guys have to miss out on to be competitive.
I mean, all of my friends that I had from high school, I don't speak to anymore. I just physically couldn't keep up the relationships with them because I was so busy with racing. You know, it's tricky. You know, you almost, I can't remember who said it to me, but someone said to me at some point this year, they said, you have to at some point choose your career or whether you want to be, you know, with your friends, and you have to choose between them. And I don't fully agree with that. Like, obviously you can keep up some friendships and stuff like that. You know, I've got a couple of really good close friends that I'll always, you know, that will always be, you know, I'll always be friends with, stuff like that. But you just don't get the time. You know, you can't spend time with them because you have to be in the gym, or you have to be at a racetrack, or you have to be on the sim preparing or something like that. And it does get underestimated. And also the eating side of things, you know, I've been on 1,500 calories for like per day for about a month now. Obviously, I think I took about 5 days off just because I was getting so frustrated with it. But yeah, no, you can't really eat. Like you get your dinner in the evening, you get maybe a snack in the afternoon or morning or something like that, and that's that. So it's, to be honest, it's a very boring life that we have away from the circuit, but there's just so much that you have to do away from the track that you don't have time for anything else.
And maybe the answer is just that you simply do, but I'm curious as to how you sustain that, because like speaking as somebody who has tried to lose weight a few times and has done the whole calorie restriction and going to the gym more, I often find I can do it for about a month and then it slips and then it capitulates. So, you know, is it purely the motivation of wanting to win that keeps you going through that? Or are there sort of mantras, things you have to keep saying to yourself to tick it along?
I think it helps when you've got people around you that are pushing you to do it. You know, my family, not so much, but you know, I've got my gym trainer, for example, my personal trainer, who he goes to the same gym as me and he's there every day coaching other people, and he knows if I've not been, so I can't really get away with it. But that's a good thing, you know, because I know that I am the sort of person that probably would say, oh, it's legs today, I won't do it. Which, you know, it's not a good trait of mine, but you know, I've put things in place deliberately so that I can't do that, because I know that that's a weakness and I can't let it affect me. And you know, the food is, the problem that I've got is I love food, and food is just so good that I just always want food, and that's the problem. Like even now, like I think I've got something in the fridge that I'd love to eat. It's been there for about a month now, or might be freezer, but yeah, you just can't, like you have to just keep on the railroads, because like you say, if you let it slip once, it slips again a couple of days later, and then it slips again and again and again, and then you're back to square one again, and then you've got to try and start again, and that's the worst part of it. So yeah, it's very, very tricky.
Have you grown to enjoy the training, or is it still something that you kind of constantly feel like you're pushing up against?
I don't enjoy training. It's just boring. Like I don't enjoy it, but I know that I have to do it, and that's why I don't mind doing it at the end of the day, because I know that if I don't, then I will never be as good of a driver that I want to be, and then I may as well just not bother even turning up to a racetrack. So you know, the amount of money that we're putting into motorsport and trying to make a career out of it, if I can't even be bothered to get into the gym and make sure I'm fit enough, then what's the point in even trying?
Well, look, let's bring it back to that end result of it all, which is, of course, the racing. Focusing on GB3 for a minute, you came in, and I'm noticing a bit of a pattern here. You won on your debut weekend. Like, what's going on, Joseph? How is it that you're capable of just jumping in these cars with minimal testing and going out and sticking it P1 on your first weekend?
I think that goes back to what I was saying before, in the fact that I've always had that disadvantage, and I've never been the one with the most testing. You know, I'm lucky if I'm not the least testing person, if that's a way of saying it. I'm lucky if I've turned up with 10 days in the car at round one, but it's taught me to be adaptable and learn cars quickly. You know, I don't have to do a session, come in, look at data, and then know how to improve. You know, I can do three laps and then know where to improve, and I'll go and find that time, and then I'll find other things. So I can just do a race run and I'll probably improve my driving by 0.3 just through a race run. And you know, that's a positive of mine that I feel like I really do think it's a good thing.
I mean, you're also a big advocate for sim racing and using the sim as well. So how much does that help make up some of the shortfall in testing?
It does really help. So I think that was something that really helped GB3 this year, because I spent a lot of the winter on my sim. It didn't even matter what car I was driving, what track, but I would put race fuel in. I'd put, for example, 50 litres of fuel in, and I'd just drive until I ran out. And, you know, I was doing endurance races, stuff like that, just to basically teach myself that every lap has to be the same as the last one. And if it's not, then I need to improve it until it is. And that was what I did. I must have spent 400 hours on my sim just driving round and round and round on my own. It was the most boring thing in the world, but it taught me a lot. And again, it goes back to that determinate, like the dedication that we have to put into motorsport. You know, 90% of the sport's off track, and that's obviously why I spend so much time on my sim. You know, it can really help consistency. And for example, for the Young Driver of the Year award that I did for the assessments at Silverstone, we did a race run in the F2 car, a car that I'd not driven before the day. And I did a race run that was pretty much every lap within 2/10 of each other. And it's that sort of stuff that it does give me the edge over the others, I think.
We'll touch on the Autosport award a bit later, but actually I'm just going to fixate on that point now, because for those who are unaware, the shootout is very much based around your performance in a range of different cars. How much of that time you've spent practicing on your sim do you think contributed to you impressing? Because it's no good just being good in the F2 car. Like, the judges are looking for the all-rounder. So do you think that practice directly has then helped you go out there in a range of different cars on the same day, same circuit, same conditions, and produce performance across them all?
I think so, yes. And I got into the habit at one point on iRacing, you can do an F4 race at 1/4 to the hour and then an F3 race 1/4 past the hour. And I would basically back-to-back the races. And it meant that I had to teach myself to just literally not do qualifying, straight into the race and be on the pace straight away. And it sounds funny. And anyone that's listened to this podcast who drives on iRacing will know that that is the worst thing you can do. But it does help, and it helps you learn, and it helps you be adaptable. And I think that's why, you know, I think we only got 12 laps in both the GT3 and the LMP3 for the assessment, and the rest was in the F2 car. But, you know, you had to get into the GT3 car and figure it out on your out lap and then be on the pace on your push lap. And that was that. You know, you didn't get any leeway. You don't have any excuses, and you've all got the same machinery. So, you know, the best man wins, I guess. And it does help, the sim stuff. You know, the drivers that say that it doesn't help just don't put enough effort into the sim to make it help, if that makes sense. So yeah, very important tool.
So we're talking about adapting to new cars. GB3 car, obviously, compared to F4, is much grippier, more power, more downforce. The aero is doing a bit more for the car. Did you find that jump as big as the Fiesta to the F4, or was it more of sort of a bit of a, if you like, F4 plus in terms of your learning?
It was probably an easier jump than it was. In fact, I'd say it was an easier jump than 2021's F4 to 2022. Just because the GB3 car, it was, the driving style is very similar to F4 in 2021. So you're off the brake early, picking up throttle quite early and driving the car through. Whereas 2022's F4 car was very big entries and hope. But the GB3 car just, it just worked for me. It made sense. It's a very nice car, nice and light. It's the low speed stuff is so nice, like the way that it rotates, things like that. And also JHR do a really good job of setting the car up to exactly how I wanted it. And that was something I made really clear at the start of testing. You know, me and Matt Rees are very different, and you can put the same car on the ground and it'd be suited to Matt and I'd be 2/10 off, and then you can do it the other way around and I'd probably be 2/10 quicker. So we had to put the cars how I wanted it instead of how Matt wanted it. And so then we went our separate ways, me and Matt, and obviously we both ended up with the same lap time, just in a completely different way. But that trust that the team gave me, and it really helped. It pushed me into my own way of driving, meant that I was a lot more comfortable in races. And it meant that the car was more suited to me. And it just meant that I could perform more often than not. When it mattered.
And how much of a milestone is that for you in your career as well? Because you come into the team as a new driver to F4, you're very much adjusting to the environment, you're leaning on what the engineers and the experts are telling you, and now 2 years later you're in a position where actually you're dictating the way to them. This is how I want the car, this is what I'm feeling. So is that for you like a big landmark moment, if you like, in your progression as a driver?
I suppose yes. I think obviously the fact that the team had so much trust in me to push the car in the direction that I wanted and to actually make the car, you know, suit me instead of what they believed suited the car necessarily. I think it I think it was a bit of an eye opener for me that I actually have quite a good feel of what's good and bad in a race car. And there was times when I would sometimes go against the team, and it would actually be a good change, and they'd turn around and say, "Well, that was a good job, well done." But then there was, I can promise you, there was a lot of times when I would change the car to what I felt was right, and it was slower, and then I'd get Pete turn around and say, "Oh, why'd you do that for?" and stuff like that. So, but yeah, no, it's, you know, the team put a lot of faith in me, and that was the main thing. And I think, just to be honest, I'm really sad that I'm not going to be racing for them next year, because, you know, if I could stay with them for the rest of my life, it would be amazing. But yeah, no, it's been a pretty cool year.
What are your thoughts on the reverse grid races?
I love them. I think they're awesome. I really do. I think they should be. I think that they're the most fun races of the weekend, apart from when you fight for a championship. I can guarantee Callum was going into the last race pooing himself, just because you just don't know if there's just going to be a pile up in front and you get collected and that's that. But I mean, it does help that I got quite lucky in some of the reverse grid races, for example, Spa. But at the same time, you know, I'm always going to say this, but you do make your own luck, and I guess you win some, you lose some. But yeah, I love the reverse grid races. They're so fun. You can fight people so hard. And when you're in the low positions, like I normally was for the reverse grid races, it's just fun at the end of the day. Like, it's that race that doesn't have as much pressure, and you can almost just enjoy doing what you do. Like, you get to race against some of the best in the UK, and it doesn't actually matter that much. It's almost like being an iRacing race.
And obviously you got the chance this year as well to experience Spa and Zandvoort as well. Just give me your thoughts on those, because the European circuits are quite different to the UK tracks, which are typically a lot narrow. There's a lot less room for error. How much do you think learning on those UK tracks then helped you going into a circuit where you have perhaps a bit more runoff and a little bit margin for error, because it's helping you to be precise?
Yeah, it's really weird, actually. I found it really tricky to get used to Spa and Zandvoort. I think Spa, I was actually fairly quick. It was hard to really tell, but obviously we had an issue in qualifying, and then that was that, and we had a lot of engine issues that weekend, and et cetera, et cetera. I think Zandvoort was a very big missed opportunity for me. You know, I should have been on the front row in qualifying, and I messed up my last lap, which, one of those, but it's just with tracks like that, you need more running to be able to be on the pace. And again, with me not having as much running as others, it was a bit of a struggle. I think I'd only done one or two days before the Spa race weekend, whereas I know some people had done like five. So, you know, I'm always on the back foot with that sort of stuff, but the tracks themselves are really enjoyable. Like, you get to drive around the tracks that your heroes have raced on, your current, you know, idols race on. It is like a little dream. Like, you go up Eau Rouge and Radion for the first time, it's like, wow, look at this. You're like a kid in a candy shop again. But yeah, no, it was pretty cool experience to race on some of those tracks.
Sorry to interrupt myself, but I just want to talk a little bit about my involvement in motorsport, and that is through my business, Meaden PR. We provide a range of promotional services for championships, teams, drivers, partners, everybody across motorsport, and that includes things like press releases, social media management, graphic design, videography, websites, you name it, we can do it. If you're looking to level up your output in 2024, please do drop us a message on our social media channels, and it'd be great to have a conversation. Anyway, back to the conversation you came for. Well, look, this is, I think, a pretty unique opportunity for people to get an insight into what it's like as a driver in the junior categories making your way through. I'm interested about your experience of the atmosphere within the paddock, because you're in this sort of weird position where you guys are mates and you spend a lot of time together on the road. They become your friends, but ultimately the reason you're there is to beat them, is to get ahead of them in your career. So can you just give me sort of an insight into how that that sort of that parallel works. Your friends and enemies all at the same time.
Yeah, I think it's like a pretend friendship with most of the drivers. You know, there's a couple that, for example, Ed Pearson is a really good friend of mine. You know, I get on with him quite well. You know, we don't speak too much, obviously, away from the track. But like, you know, when we see each other, we'll always go over to each other, give each other a hug, and say hello. And also, this is a bit off topic, but I will shout Ed out for this at Zandvoort. I can't remember when it was. We had a really bad practice day on the Friday before quali. I think I was like P15 or something, and I genuinely felt like I'd done a good job. And I remember sitting on the barrier, like inside the paddock, completely away from everyone. And I saw Ed coming over, and I was like sat there literally crying to myself because I thought I'd lost the championship at that point. And Ed comes over, puts his arm around me, and you know, genuinely was really trying to console me. And you don't get that with a lot of drivers. You know, I don't think there's any other driver on the grid that would have done that. And that's why me and Ed have so much respect for each other. But yeah, no, I think when you're racing with someone in a championship fight, someone like, for example, Callum or Alex, you know, we can speak to each other. Like we can get along, but I don't think we can ever really be friends until after our careers or we're racing in different categories or something like that. You know, I just don't think it's really possible, especially when you're fighting for a championship.
What did Ed say to you that day when he helped pick you up?
I honestly can't remember the exact words that he said, but he basically just put his arm around me and, you know, basically almost just motivated me. Like, he was basically saying stuff like, you know, you know you're fighting for this championship because you're good enough, and there's a reason why you're there up until this point, and you've not all of a sudden forgotten how to drive, stuff like that. And obviously my family, I've always done that through my whole career as well, but to hear it come from another driver, it means so much because of the amount of respect that you've managed to build up without even knowing it as well. You know, I can't thank Ed enough for that, because the amount of motivation that gave me, and obviously then qualified, I think P5 or something like that the next day, which was, it was okay. You know, it was a massive uplift for me, and it kept me in the title fight, I think, that weekend. And yeah, just, I can't thank him enough for it, because it really did help me.
So more generally, on a weekend like that, where you know you've got a little bit of time to find, talk me through the process. Where do you begin when you're looking for that extra tenth?
I mean, a lot of it comes from feeling for myself. So like, I'll come in and I'll know that I've left a little bit on the table in, for example, turn five. Maybe I needed to go a little bit slower in and get a better exit, stuff like that. And I can normally feel it. But a lot of the time, you know, we have to look at the data and just properly, you know, examine it, look through it, and make sure that what we're telling ourselves is true, because sometimes the feeling that we get is wrong. And it has happened before that I've felt something and it's been the opposite and stuff like that. But I think, obviously, when you get to the point that you're trying to find hundredths, you're normally doing a pretty good job anyway, and you're normally not far off the front. So you get to that point, and then you have to start not only looking at driving, but you have to look at the car and what can you change with the car that can help you then find the time in driving, which is something that I felt I did quite well this year. You know, Alton Park, for example, round one, I felt the car was too oversteery for me, a little bit too pointy. So for qualifying, I settled it down, and it did give me the edge over Matt, and that was what gave me pole. And just little things like that that don't necessarily make the car quicker, but it makes it easier to extract the lap time. And that's where I feel you can get the extra few hundredths over everyone else.
So we've talked a lot about the on-track stuff, but obviously another thing you need to be successful in motorsport, as we've also touched upon, is funding. I think anybody in any job would struggle if they knew that any time now the funding for their job might go away. I think they would struggle to stay motivated, whatever you're doing. How do you kind of keep that fear at bay that you're putting in all this effort? You've got so much dedication, commitment. Like you say, you're spending hours on the sim. You're really sort of learning your craft. How do you get away from this sort of thought in the back of your mind that, like, could be my last year, next year could be my last year, maybe the year after that? Like, how do you keep that at bay?
it's never really a thought that I have, you know. It's, I mean, I've had it every, in fact, this year is the first year that I know that I'll be racing next year, whether, you know, no matter what. But because even last year, the year before, stuff like that, I was like, well, this could be my last year of racing. But I guess I kind of have to look at my whole career up to now as a whole and look at it and go, if I was my 10-year-old self and someone came over to me and said, you know, by the time you're 18, you're going to be in GB3, you're going to have fought for the championship, you're going to have won the Young Driver of the Year award, I'd have taken that. I'd have said, oh, well, I'm well chuffed for that. You know, that's awesome. I'd never thought I'd get there. And therefore, to me, of course, I want to make Formula One and I want to be a Formula One world champion and I want to be the best of all time and stuff like that. That's the aspirations. But you have to remember where you came from and look at where you are now and realize that the effort that you've put in has got you to a point where you're looked at as, you know, you are one of the best in the world, whether you like it, whether you like to say it or not. You know, I'm in the top probably 100 racing drivers, like current in single seaters right now. And that's something that you can't really gloss over. And, you know, it's not like you're doing it for nothing, you know. F1 isn't the only goal. You can go to GTs, you can go to prototypes, stuff like that. So, you know, I don't think I've ever really looked at that too much. But yeah, it's nice to have a bit of security, that's for sure.
So have there come points where you and your family have really seriously had to look at calling time on it?
Yeah, I think at the end of 2022 we were close. But of course, I'm very glad that we didn't, because obviously this is my best year yet by far. And to be honest, it's all down to my family. You know, it didn't actually take too much convincing, but we were thinking, you know, this is a lot of money now. We're not a family that can just throw hundreds of thousands at stuff and be completely fine afterwards. You know, for next year, we're most likely going to have to put our extension on hold at home just to be able to afford racing, which, so many people would go, why on earth do you do that? But it's the fact of where we are. It's like, people could only ever dream to be here, so you've got to make the most of the opportunity you've got. And yeah, I guess that, yeah.
It's an investment in you at the end of the day, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly.
So you are sitting here today as the latest recipient of the Aston Martin Autosport BRDC Award, which I guess for people who don't know, is the most prestigious prize you can get in the UK. As a young driver, I'm looking at a list of previous winners in front of me now. Jenson Button, David Coulthard, George Russell, Lando Norris. You've got all these iconic names, Joseph, and now yours as well. I'm going to take it right back to the beginning of the process. Do you remember where you were and what you were feeling when you first realised you'd got the nod, you'd had the nomination, and you were going to go through to the last four and compete for this?
Yeah, I was in my car, actually, and I got a call from Kevin Turner, I think it was. I got a call from Kevin and he said, oh, congratulations, Joseph, you're in the top four. And I was like, fantastic, brilliant. But I didn't even know what that entailed because I hadn't really looked into it because I was like, oh, I'm in the top 10. That's quite cool. But I didn't know really what it entailed. I didn't know I had to go to Silverstone and stuff like that until I was told, obviously, a couple of days after. But I remember, obviously, I was driving at the time. I got off the phone with Kevin, straight away called my mum and I was like, Mum, you'll never guess what. She goes, what? We were in the top four. And obviously, yeah, we were obviously chatting about that for half an hour. But then obviously got then put online on the way back from Zandvoort. And then, of course, I will touch on this quickly. It's a bit different to your question, but I went for the Autosport Awards, the assessment days, I was sat outside the garage before I went in, and it was the Tuesday, so it was the day that Luke was driving the F1 car, and I was the only driver there that was going to be competing, because the other three were in Imola, I think. And I remember sitting in my car for about 5 minutes, and I was just so scared to just go inside, because I knew that the amount of people that were in there that I've looked up to and that have made so many big things out of motorsport, etc., etc., it's like, it felt so surreal to me. And the whole experience of the Young Driver of the Year Award and stuff, like, it's just, you can't put it into words how extraordinary it is. You know, I was talking to Johnny Herbert like he's my best mate, and it just felt so strange. I had to take a step back and just go, oh, this is mental. Even a year ago, I wouldn't even thought this would happen. I just remember being so overwhelmed with the whole thing.
I mean, I'm sure there's a lot you can't discuss, but how did you find the assessment process? We've touched on the different cars you've got to drive as well, but that's not all the assessment, is it? There's a lot more that goes into it than just if you're quick on a one-lap basis.
Obviously, the F2 car was the most crazy thing I've driven. It was about the same lap times as FIA F3, which is obviously a lot quicker than GB3. But I felt that it was quite easy for me to adjust to in a weird way. I'm trying to think of the right word, but I almost kind of made it feel not real. So I tried to tell myself that I was just on my sim or something like that, because on my sim I can be on pace in a car within 5 laps, and that was what I tried to do in the actual assessments. And I think that almost making it feel not real helps, because it makes it just everything slows down a little bit more. You don't have that fear factor that is the worst thing that a driver can ever have. Yeah, to be honest, I was just enjoying myself, especially in the wet on the second day. That was mint. The thing was sideways everywhere. It's just hanging out. You were getting wheel spin on the exit of Stowe if you hit the curbs. And it was just, just the amount of power that you've got with such a light car was just, it was mind-blowing.
Did you find the GT quite an eye-opener as well? Because I think when you're coming up through junior single-seaters, I think more and more young drivers are recognising GTs as a good career route where the cars are a lot of fun to drive and there's money in it. But how did you find that sort of first lap in a totally different type of car to what you're used to?
Yeah, I mean, the GTs are, there's more grip than what you think. You think that they float around and they're all bussy and stuff. They're not. They're actually really quite quick. And, you know, you turn into, for example, cops, and it actually does, it turns quite well. It'll grip. And, it's quite impressive how a car that heavy can have so much grip. But unfortunately, we didn't have the best conditions for the cars. It was a drying day, so it had rained overnight. And they kept us all on wets for the whole assessment to try and make it fair, because obviously if they put two of us on slicks, two of us on wets, it's not really, they can't use it at all. So they chucked us on the wets. And I think by the end of the day, I think Barnard was the last person out in the GT, and he was on a dry track in the wets, and he got one lap, and that was that. The actual conditions weren't ideal, but the cars are still incredible, the P3 as well. I was actually slightly underwhelmed by the LMP3. I thought it would feel a bit quicker than it was. But of course, that could have just been the conditions, I don't know. It still felt really cool to just sit in them and drive them and stuff like that, just to get an experience of what they feel like. And it was pretty enjoyable.
You mentioned some of the notable names that there are on the judging panel for that award as well. Can you remember any sort of pieces of advice they gave you before the assessment?
The main one that I got off pretty much every judge was just enjoy it. You know, just remember that there's not that many people get to do this. And to be honest, that's never something I've ever really struggled with anyway. I've always been the one that'll, you know, just take a step back and realize where I am and, you know, how important it is to, you know, do what we're doing. They just basically said, enjoy it and have a good time. And that's what I did. I deliberately made sure that from lap one, I was enjoying myself. You know, they sent us out on a wet run at the start, on wets. It was fully dry in the F2 just to basically get ourselves comfortable. And I remember I did one lap and the tyres were destroyed. And I was just sliding around, just having a good laugh, literally opposite lock, fully 45 degree the wrong way through cops, just having a good bit of fun. And that was what they said was really important to do. And just made sure I enjoyed it.
So the awards night was very recently. It's the annual Autosport Awards, big event, Black Tie Gala, everybody who's anybody is going, and you were announced as the winner in front of a packed ballroom. Just take me inside your mind at the moment your name is read out.
I can't. There was so much that happened just at the, yeah, it was just overwhelming is the only word that I can use. You know, the amount of emotions that I'd gone through that whole evening, to be honest. They put us on stage at 8:30 and showed us off to all of the really, you know, amazing people that were there. You know, you've got F1 team bosses, you know, really high up people in F1 teams. I can't name names because obviously it was so many, but just, you know, they make us stand on the stage and look out at them all. Then they send us back to our seats, get us to eat a 3-course meal and wait 3 hours for our award to be called. And you can imagine for the last half hour, my hands were just shaking the whole time. And I was so, yeah, so like just nervous for what was about to be told to us, whether I'd won or not. And yeah, just, I'm just over the moon, really.
What did the other three say to you? Did you have a chance to speak to them afterwards?
I spoke to Callum quite a bit. You know, obviously me and Callum know each other fairly well from GB3. And, you know, he came over, said, well done. We just basically had a chat about how our assessments went, you know, what we felt we did badly and what we felt we did well. And, you know, it was really respectful. It was nice to see, obviously, Taylor and Callum being quite respectful and, you know, saying well done. You know, I know I would have done the same. It's quite appreciated when obviously you've fought so hard for something so big, and for them to still recognise the fact that I think it's just really nice to have that sort of respect, and it's great to have that within motorsport.
So we're recording this in mid-December, so it is a couple of weeks since you won the award. I guess the big question is, has the magnitude of what you've done sunk in yet?
Not at all in any way. You know, I think I'm starting to realise from the kind of the people that have started to contact me about next year, things like that. You know, I think I do kind of realise how decent it is. I mean, decent is a bit of an understatement, but you know, it's a massive opportunity for me, and that's why I'm looking so strongly at next year now, and why I'm so confident for the plans, because I think, you know, we can make a big step forward next year thanks to this award, and that wouldn't have been possible without it. And I think that's what's actually making me realise it more than anything, because, you know, I wouldn't get the opportunities I'm getting. And yeah, I mean, you just have to look at the names of the people that have won it before. You know, every single one of them have gone on to big things, and whether that be Formula One or, you know, prototypes, things like that, you just, everyone that's won the award has gone on to something big. And the fact that my name's now there is just, it gives me a lot of belief that, you know, I can do the same, and, you know, maybe I can make something like that out of it too.
And of course, this time next year, you're going to get to drive a Formula One car, which I imagine might be the most surreal thing of all.
I still can't believe it. It's a childhood dream, isn't it? You know, all of us, every single racing driver, no matter what you race, you know, if you race a GT car, you want to drive an F1 car. If you drive a prototype, you want to drive an F1 car. It doesn't matter what you race. And even people outside of motorsport, you know, if you walked into a pub and asked, you know, Barry from Down Road if he wanted to drive an F1 car, he'd say that'd be an absolute dream. And the fact that I'm going to get to live that is just going to be so special, and I really hope I can make the most of it. I really hope it's dry. It's just going to be so awesome to drive a Formula One car and to experience that level of technology and that level of car just in general is going to be just, yeah, out of this world.
So let's bring this full circle then. I guess my question is, if you look at your career as a whole, knowing what you know now, experiencing what you've been through, what advice would you give to 10-year-old Joseph in rental carts starting out? Like, what would your message to him be?
I'd just say always believe in yourself, and, you know, don't ever let people say that you can't do something, because that's something I've had throughout my career a lot. You know, when I first started out, when I was in Fiestas as well, I was in high school, and they might have said it out of jealousy, they might have meant it, but I had quite a few people that would say, you know, why do you bother? You're never going to make anything out of it. You know, what's the point in trying? And I ignored them all. And, you know, I think that's the best thing I could have done. I believed in myself, and if I could go back to 10-year-old Joseph and say something, it would be that. Just never let anyone else restrict what you can do. And, you know, just always believe in yourself, and you know, you can always do, you can do anything you want. You just have to make it work for yourself. And a route that someone else did isn't necessarily the route that you have to take. You can always make your own route and kind of pioneer your own version of what you believe is success.
You speak very well about the whole experience. And I often think that in the junior single-seater environment, I mean, you guys are teenagers, but you grow up fast. I guess my question is, how do you reflect on how you've developed personally over the last few years, as well as professionally around your racing?
I think I've matured really well. I think it's something that I knew I needed to do. I was obviously 15 years old. I didn't really know how to act. I didn't know what sort of a person I should be. But I think also something that I did that I'm really glad I did was I didn't lose any of my personality. You know, I had quite a few people at the start of 2021, and I was just, you know, like I say, I was just having fun, and I was just a kid, just having a laugh and enjoying myself. And I had a few people say, you know, you've got to be more professional, you've got to be this, you've got to be that. And I said, no, I don't want, if I have to do that, I don't want to do this, because then I'm not going to enjoy it, and I'm not going to be myself. And if I do make it somewhere, then I'll make it being someone that I'm not, and it won't feel like I've succeeded. And to be honest, I think I did it at a good time, because I feel like at the moment there is a bit of that revolution where drivers are more of a marketing tool than they are a publicity tool now. And, you know, I think, for example, Lando Norris, you know, he's people like him because he's got a good personality, and he's funny, and he's happy, and stuff like that. And I think that's something that I've always tried to do myself. And it's important, because I'm not going to name names, but there's drivers that I've been in the paddock with that have got zero personality, and you just know that they won't make it anywhere, because they'll choose someone that's easier to publicize and easier to make content with and stuff like that. And that's the way that the world is now. And I think that's the best thing I could have done.
Yeah, I guess it's that sense that people want to connect with the drivers. I remember when I was a kid, nobody really watched Formula One. I had the same thing as you. I used to have mates who are a bit like, why'd you bother with that? It's rich people driving in circles. But these are the same people now who love Formula One because they've watched Drive to Survive, and they can see the person underneath the crash helmet, if that makes sense. So when they see it on TV now, because drivers are so concealed within the car, you've almost given that car, if you like, a personality by knowing the driver in it. So, no, I completely get that. So on this podcast, traditionally, the guest would ask the final question to the listeners. But because it's the last episode before the end of the year, I'm going to shake it up slightly. Now, I'm willing to bet there are more than a couple of young drivers listening to this, perhaps looking to pick up some tips and some advice. So my question would be, Joseph, what question would you tell young drivers or drivers coming through the ranks to go away and ask themselves to help themselves unlock maybe an extra tenth on track next time they're out in the car?
I like that. I've got to think about this one, because this is important. I'd say to any driver that is starting out in kind of the even karting, or even maybe you're into Formula 4 or something like that, and you know, you want to aspire to be in Formula 1 like I am currently, I'd say the main thing you have to ask yourself is, how much do you want it, and how much do you really, how much you were willing to put into this to make it work at the end of the day. And you've got to put 110% of your life into motorsport if you want to make it work. And if you're not willing to do that, then you know, you have to make the decision of whether you're going to keep pursuing this or you're going to give up. And you know, it's either 100% or nothing, and that's the best thing you could do.
We're going to end with our usual quickfire questions round. Are you ready?
Go. All right, go on.
Who has had the greatest influence on your career?
My My mom.
What lesson in life took you the longest to learn?
You have to give respect to earn respect.
What's your biggest fear?
Losing.
What skill would you still like to learn away from motorsport?
This is a weird one. I'd quite like to be a good singer. I don't know why. You'll never get that one again, I bet. But I feel like singing would be quite cool.
And lastly, in a word, what has your life in motorsport given you?
Happiness.
There you go. And I think really, Joseph, that's the perfect answer to end on, because you are a ruthless competitor. But having known you 3 or 4 years, I would always say you're somebody who goes about their business with a smile. So, I think that's perfect. And thank you so much for a great conversation, and best of luck for next year. And congratulations once again on the Autosport BRDC Aston Martin Award.
Thank you very much, Damien. Really appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
I mean, that is without a doubt one of my favourite conversations we've done so far, and the perfect way to send this podcast into the New Year break. It was just such a refreshing conversation, and so great to hear so candidly and honestly from one of Britain's top single-seater talents right now, and to hear about the lack of testing, about coming back from being an underdog, never giving up, and above all, having the belief in himself for Joseph to go and make it to where he is now with that prestigious Aston Martin Autosport BRDC Award. I cannot wait to see what happens for him in 2024 and where his career goes from there. And I'd also just like to take the opportunity to wish you all a very enjoyable festive period and a very happy new year, and to say that Motorsport Mentality will be back in 2024. Until then, my name's Damien Meaden, and we'll speak to you then.